Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the full-page ad in Saturday's New York Times demanding that Hillary Clinton disavow her anti-Israel advisers and speak with one of her alleged advisers, Max Blumenthal, who, along with his father, Sid Blumenthal, is the subject of the attack ad. He joins us to discuss the annual meeting of the pro-Israel lobby AIPAC, now underway in Washington, which he is outside of among protesters. With a much-anticipated address to AIPAC by Donald Trump scheduled for Monday, we will discuss why Bernie Sanders, the first Jewish-American presidential candidate, is not attending the conference, which has refused to allow him to contribute remarks by video. Then we'll go to Havana, Cuba, to speak with Mark Frank, a freelance journalist based in Cuba who works for Reuters and the Financial Times and is the author of Cuban Revelations, Behind the Scenes in Havana. We will discuss the anticipation and excitement surrounding President Obama's historic visit to Cuba later today, the first by an American president since 1928, and assess the beginning of the end of an almost six-decades-long dysfunctional relationship with a neighboring country 90 miles from Florida. Then we'll go to Arizona for an update on Tuesday's Democratic primary, where Hillary Clinton is leading in the polls, and speak with Bill Velasquez, the National Director of Latino Outreach for the Bernie Sanders campaign, to see whether there will be another come-from-behind victory by his candidate, as there was in Michigan and almost was in Missouri and Illinois. Then finally, we'll get an analysis of the political mood in Arizona from Rodolfo Espino, a professor of political science at Arizona State University, where he specializes in American politics, racial politics, and political identity. We will discuss the student protests that blocked the highway leading to a Trump rally and the visit to Sheriff Arpaio's infamous Tent City prison by Bernie Sanders' wife. And joining us now is Max Blumenthal, who's a senior editor of Alternet's Gray Zone Project and an award-winning investigative journalist, documentary filmmaker, columnist, media commentator, whose books include the New York Times bestselling Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party, and Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. His latest book is The 51-Day War, Ruin and Resistance in Gaza. Welcome to Background Briefing, Max Blumenthal.
Good to be on with you, Ian.
And Max, you're, I believe, in front of where the AIPAC conference is underway. Of course, the much-anticipated address by Donald Trump is on Monday. And as I mentioned in the opening, the first Jewish-American presidential candidate will not be attending the conference, and apparently the organizers have refused to allow him to contribute remarks by video. You had a role, I believe, in advising Bernie Sanders not to attend. Can you fill us in on that?
Yeah, and just so your listeners know, if you're the sound is a little bit compromised, because I am hailing right now a very large march in protest of AIPAC and protesting the presence not only of Donald Trump, but of Benjamin Netanyahu and Hillary Clinton. And Bernie Sanders is experiencing a lot of support within this march. You see a lot of people at this march protesting AIPAC, wearing Bernie Sanders stickers, holding Bernie Sanders signs, and they say that, you know, we're part of a political revolution that's going to go beyond this campaign. And so I played a part in just trying to help mobilize them to let their voices be heard through a petition calling on Sanders not to appear at AIPAC, calling on him to have the courage of his convictions, because he said that he wants to be a fair broker and doesn't want to take sides between Israel and the Palestinians. And so we got 5,000 signatures at change.org. At another site, we received 14,000 signatures. We've got a lot of media pickup, and I think Bernie Sanders realized that his supporters, especially his hardcore supporters who are going out and volunteering for him, would rather have him campaigning on the border of his own country in Arizona than pandering to a foreign lobby in Washington. And it's really a remarkable moment. It shows where the Democratic Party is going, that its base, its progressive base, does not support Netanyahu's Israel and really doesn't support the U.S.-Israel special relationship.
And of course, Bernie Sanders has said that he's simply busy campaigning in the West. But the fact that he offered to address the conference by videotape and the organizers of the APAC leadership decided not to allow that to happen, what do you make of that?
Well, Benjamin Netanyahu will be addressing by videotape. There have been many candidates who've been allowed to address by video, but this is a snub to Bernie Sanders. It's about AIPAC punishing him because they don't feel confident that he will support the special relationship. And what that means is not, you know, supporting a two-state solution, supporting the peace process, supporting the established policy of the U.S. since every president since Eisenhower. It's about supporting the project of Greater Israel. We heard Marco Rubio, the candidate who is really the choice of many of the figures who are funding the pro-Israel lobby, specifically Sheldon Adelson and Paul Singer. We heard Rubio use the phrase Judea and Samaria in a Republican debate, and that's a reference to the West Bank, but it's the term that the settler movement uses for the West Bank, and it's basically code for Greater Israel, that the West Bank will be permanently occupied and eventually annexed into Israel. That's where AIPAC is going. And if you just look at AIPAC's speaker list of people who will appear there, it's more right-wing than ever before. I mean, there are very few actual liberal Democrats who are participating in AIPAC. And as I said, this shows where the Democratic Party's going. The pro-Israel lobby can no longer boast bipartisan consensus. And so Bernie Sanders being snubbed is just the beginning. We're going to see tomorrow a walkout against Donald Trump from within AIPAC, and that's, to me, not because of his hateful rhetoric. There are plenty of figures at AIPAC who are spouting hateful rhetoric. As we've written at Alternet, the issue is that they don't feel like they can control Donald Trump because he's a self-funding candidate. He doesn't need them like Marco Rubio does. So that's another factor in the increasing, I think, the decline of AIPAC as a dominant force in American politics.
And again, I'm speaking with Max Blumenthal, who is an investigative journalist and senior editor of Alternet's Gray Zone Project. He's the author of Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. And his latest book is The 51-Day War, Ruin and Resistance in Gaza. Now, as I mentioned, and I'm sure a lot of people noticed, in Saturday's New York Times, a full-page ad saying Hillary Clinton must disavow her anti-Israel advisors. And they go on to describe you and your father, Max Blumenthal, Sid Blumenthal, as essentially as anti-Semites refer to Israelis as Judeo-Nazis, et cetera, et cetera. So, first of all, I'm surprised that you are an advisor to Hillary Clinton. How did that happen?
Yeah, well, you know, I just told her to go full BDS, but no, I, you know, if you think I'm advising Hillary Clinton, you probably need to be lobotomized or subjected to some form of medicalization.
Well, I didn't think you were, but this is a very a real attack ad. And it accuses you of essentially, well, being an anti-Semite. Is this funded? I know it's this Rabbi Shmuley Boitik is allegedly behind it, but I think it's probably Sheldon Adelson who paid for it. Hello? Did I lose Max? Oh, I see. I did. Okay. Well, we're trying to get him back on. And again, I'm speaking with Max Blumenthal, investigative journalist. Are you there, Max?
Hello? I lost you for.
Yeah, yeah. I said, Sheldon Adelson pay for this ad?
You know, I have a suspicion that someone who's close to Adelson named Adam Milstein paid for it. This ad was overseen by Shmuley Boitik, who says that he's America's rabbi, but he's actually Ted Cruz's rabbi. He's someone who's very close to the far right wing of the Republican Party, and he's been serving as Sheldon Adelson's bagman for years. Adelson gave him $1 million to run for Congress in New Jersey, and Adelson has really funded his entire apparatus. And the ad is an attempt to kind of paint Hillary Clinton, hilariously so, as anti-Israel, with these two Jewish puppet masters controlling him, me and my father. My father does have a long-standing relationship with the Clintons, and it's a ridiculous ad. I mean, it sources some of my father's emails to Hillary Clinton, which were appeared either through FOIA or were through FOIA requests. And, you know, I think a lot of what he says is empirically provable, that, for example, Netanyahu is very hostile to Barack Obama and wants to continue expanding settlements. I think there's very little debate about that. And then it accuses me of calling Israelis Judeo-Nazis, which is actually a defamation. Shmuley Botiach knows that that's false. I can prove that he knows it's false. And so he went ahead and lied anyway to paint me as an anti-Semite. Actually, the Judeo-Nazis reference was made by Yeshayahu Leibovitch, a famous Israeli philosopher who I wrote about in my book, Goliath. He was a dissident philosopher in Israel and an intellectual and activist. And so by merely quoting him, they accused me of saying that. So this is a false and defamatory ad that appeared in on the full page of the New York Times. They apparently have no policy on being truthful. And beyond that, it's the first time that my book, Goliath, which sold tens of thousands of copies and is really my journalistic survey of Israel-Palestine under Netanyahu, it's the first time the New York Times has mentioned my book. So there's a lot to say about the ad, but on its face, I think it's seen as ridiculous. And it's an ad by the right wing of the Israel lobby to paint Hillary Clinton as anti-Israel ahead of AIPAC. The problem is they don't have a candidate of their own who's seen as firmly pro-Israel.
Well, they have Donald Trump, who's speaking tomorrow, and that's probably the real headliner for this year's AIPAC conference. What is your anticipation that people are going to be walking out based on?
Well, there are a group of liberal rabbis affiliated with the Reform congregation who are planning to walk out on Donald Trump, and that's sort of expected. You know, they're connected to the Democratic Party, but nobody knows what Trump is going to say. And in the last Republican debate, Trump was asked about his views on Israel-Palestine, and he reiterated that he thinks that Palestinians should know that the U.S. is an honest broker so that we can make a deal. The rest of the candidates said that it's not possible to make a deal with Palestinians, that they're just inveterate terrorists. So if Donald Trump uses that kind of language again at AIPAC, I think you're going to see mounting resistance from the pro-Israel lobby, which could easily move over and support Hillary Clinton. We saw Robert Kagan, one of the founders of the Project for a New American Century, this kind of umbrella group of neoconservatives who pushed the invasion of Iraq and pushed a war on Iran, actually endorsed Hillary Clinton. His wife, Victoria Nuland, served in the Obama administration. The neoconservatives, who really represent kind of the right wing of the pro-Israel lobby, They're not loyal to any party. They're loyal to an ideology, which has American exceptionalism and support for greater Israel at its core. So that's why I think AIPAC is so interesting, and this will be a decisive few days in determining where these forces go. And I think Hillary Clinton will be appealing for their support through a series of kind of dog whistle phrases about other candidates not supporting our allies. And that's a reference to Donald Trump.
Well, as you know, Max Blumenthal, Sheldon Adelson has bought the biggest circulated newspaper in Israel today, Israel Hayom, Israel Today. Is a free newspaper. It's largely dedicated to supporting Benjamin Netanyahu and the Likud party. However, in the last few days, they have had front page coverage, fawning coverage of Donald Trump, just basically lauding him. So as much as Adelson and company may be supporting Ted Cruz, his newspaper in Israel is clearly supporting Donald Trump. So I don't think there's much doubt there that Trump is their man, and I suspect he's, given the influence of this newspaper, he probably has a lot of support in Israel.
Hillary Clinton has the most support among the Israeli public. She has double the support of Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders. But it's interesting to see Adelson make this move. Adelson even said at a semi-private meeting that, you know, he could support Donald Trump as the nominee. Adelson's wife, Miriam Adelson, who makes a lot of decisions for him, is said to be a supporter of Ted Cruz. And Ted Cruz would be someone I would think that the pro-Israel lobby would be very comfortable with. I mean, this is someone who said that he wants to carpet bomb Israel's enemies. So when you look at Adelson, you have to look at him also as a businessman who has a business empire around the world, who wants to do business with a Republican president. He thinks that he might think that he wants to domesticate Trump. And wants to get, and there's also a sense not only among pro-Israel advocates, but even among people who are uncomfortable with the special relationship with Israel, that Trump's rhetoric about Muslims is all bluster, and that he's just saying that to appeal to the far-right base of the Republican Party. And in fact, he'll be an isolationist, and he will actually be the anti-war candidate. So the interesting thing is that you see support from Sheldon Adelson, but you also see that Donald Trump is outpolling other Republican candidates among Muslims, which is amazing. Mm. I really think it's the sense that he's kind of a phony. He'll say anything, but that he isn't controlled by any external lobby. So from Sheldon Adelson's perspective, it's like, let's get in while we can and domesticate Trump. Then again, you have Paul Singer, who's been involved with Sheldon Adelson in funding Republican candidates and funding a lot of pro-Israel initiatives. And he threw his money behind Marco Rubio. He went in with Rubio lock, stock, and barrel. Now that Rubio's out, the question is, where will Paul Singer's money go to? I think Singer is actually going to be contributing as much money as Adelson to this election cycle, but he's much lesser known. Sure. So there are many factors, and Adelson isn't the only one.
Well, Max Blumenthal, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Max Blumenthal, who's a senior editor of Alternet's Gray Zone Project. He's an award-winning investigative journalist, documentary filmmaker, columnist, media commentator, and he is the author of Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. And his latest book is The 51-Day War, Ruin and Resistance in Gaza. And he joined us from a group of protesters in front of AIPAC's annual meeting in Washington, D.C. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back and go to Havana, Cuba. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now from Havana, Cuba, is Mark Frank, a freelance journalist based in Cuba who works for Thomson Reuters and the Financial Times and consults for ABC News and has contributed to The Economist and Argentina's Clarín. He's the author of Cuba Looks to the Year 2000 and Cuban Revelations Behind the Scenes in Havana. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Frank.
Hi, how are you?
Well, thanks, Mark. And you're in Havana, where there's a great deal of anticipation. President Obama arrives tonight. This is the first time a U.S. president has visited Cuba in 88 years. The last one was back in 1928, Calvin Coolidge. So in that sense, it's pretty historic. But I take it there's a lot of sort of festive anticipation. I've seen photos of people wearing American flags on their clothing, etc., improvised sort of American flag outfits. What are you seeing there?
Well, look, I mean, this is really, for the Cuban people, a cathartic event, you know? After 54 years of standing up or doing whatever with the big country next door, all of a sudden, that's all changing. And the Cuban people, of course, are thrilled that that's all changing. They look at it as a chance to have a better life, and they're very happy. And some people are putting up flags. Some people are walking around with American flags on their clothing. But, you know, talking to people around the country, they're just all, you know, they're all kind of waiting with bated breath. This is an event that almost nobody in Cuba who's alive today ever thought they would see. So it's really very important to them. The entire country is going to be glued to their television sets this afternoon when he arrives at about 4:30. And I'm sure there'll be thousands of people who actually saw it. Cry. It's very cathartic, is how I would put it.
And I've seen pictures of Raul Castro and President Obama. They're pretty ubiquitous. This obviously is a big deal for Raul Castro, and it's also equally obvious that Fidel Castro is not on those pictures, and I believe Obama is not going to meet with Fidel Castro.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, Fidel Castro did appear today in photos, meeting with Venezuelan President Maduro. So he's kind of popped in uninvited, almost, I would say, at least by our side. But no, he's not going to be involved in the trip. Fidel Castro has basically been out of power and on the sidelines now for many, many years. One of the reasons Obama's coming is because he was already in post-Castro mode. They've been changing now for 10 years. And so he's there, but he's really not going to be playing any kind of role in the actual visit.
And what's the sense of who's showing up there? There's a sense that there's going to be a sort of bonanza of a American carpet-bagging businessmen going down there to try and make deals.
We just had a press conference with the Minister of Foreign Investment and Trade here, and he said 100 delegations of businessmen from the United States visited last year. So there's a constant, you know, coming and going of people from the United States taking a look around, making their first contacts, trying to see what's available. But, you know, the minister here was as clear as everybody else is here. There's not much that's going to happen until the embargo is lifted for a series of reasons. Yes, yesterday, actually, Starwood from the United States became the first U.S. company since 1959 to sign an agreement to manage two hotels here in Cuba, and also announced that they would be putting millions of dollars into renovating those two hotels. That's, of course, spectacular. But it's very small. There's so much more that could be done. But, you know, for Starwood to come here and do that, they needed a special license from OFAC. They can't just come here and do what they want, mainly because of the embargo, but also because on the Cuban side, this is a very different kind of place than our business people are used to. You don't just come here and decide you want to buy something, buy it, run it, sell it. Nothing like that. No, you come in, and you basically have to partner with the Cuban state if you want to get anything done here. So it's a very complicated business. The embargo is going to have to be lifted on this side. They're going to have to loosen up more before we really get any kind of normal economic activity going between the two countries. But it's a step in the right direction. Everything that's happened.
Well, but having the President of the United States visit Cuba, it would be very hard subsequently for Americans not to visit Cuba, and particularly Cuban Americans from Miami, and they already been visiting in any case. So do you expect a huge uptick in visits? I mean, it's almost inevitable,
sure.
Isn't it?
I mean, sure. Yes, we do. I mean, this, you know, actually Cuba's capacity to absorb more Americans in the capital and in a few other places is not great. But the country as a whole, you know, there's plenty of capacity, but a lot of it is kind of pure tourism, going to the beach, that kind of thing, which U.S. citizens are still not allowed to do. So there'll be an increase in the presence of U.S. visitors here, but certainly for the next 2 or 3 years until some more hotels go up, et cetera, it's not going to be as much as people think because there's a limit to the capacity on the Cuban side to absorb more visitors. Again, because the Americans have to do certain things. You can't just go to the beach, you can't go to hotels, drop by Havana for a day or anything like that.
But on the other side, there was always a fear in terms of normalization that suddenly the minute that Cuba opened up to the world and opened up to the United States, there'd be a huge exodus of Cubans. That's not in the cards, I take it. There's no relaxation of people wanting to leave.
Well, you know, again, what have we seen? Well, the Cubans lifted all their restrictions on travel here about 3 years ago, and there wasn't a big increase. But as soon as the normalization process began and Cubans began to worry that their getting free card that they have and nobody else has might end and they'd be treated like immigrants from any other country, well, they began to flock to the United States. So we had a huge spike last year in Cubans crossing the Mexican border, et cetera. When relations are established, everything's normal, immigration is normal, we'll have to see how that all plays out. Certainly, every Cuban just about has family and friends in the United States. Many Cubans would like to live in the United States and live in Cuba at the same time, of course. So we'll have to see how it plays out.
And again, I'm speaking with Mark Frank, who's a freelance journalist based in Cuba who works for Thomson Reuters and the Financial Times and consults for ABC News. He's contributed to The Economist and Argentina's Clarín and is the author of Cuba Looks to the Year 2000 and Cuban Revelations Behind the Scenes in Havana. And in terms of Cubans who are banned from returning to Cuba, is that likely to lift? In other words, the gusanos, as they're called, who have escaped, would they be able to go back at some point or other? Because there are some families that need...
Yeah, I think, you know, the policy at this point is everybody can go back and forth now, with the exception of people who the Cuban government feels were involved in some kind of, you know, what they call counter-revolutionary activity, which many times did include violence. So right now, lots of people who before were banned from returning are returning. I mean, there was 300,000 Cuban Americans who visited the country last year. So many are not recent immigrants. Many are from generations past. I've sat here and had dinner with many very, very wealthy Cuban American businessmen who thought they'd never be allowed to come back, and they're coming back and forth.
So when you were saying earlier, Mark Frank, that Fidel Castro, who is not meeting with President Obama, had a meeting on Sunday with Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro, there's not a two-track foreign policy going on there where you've got Raul meeting with the President of the United States and Fidel meeting with Maduro, who, needless to say, doesn't have friendly relationships with the U.S.,
Well, no, not really, because Maduro also met with Raul Castro for hours and had a business conference here, et cetera. So I wouldn't call it dual track. I think what it is that Cuba's trying to signal to a number of governments in Latin America, not just Venezuela, that it's not changing its foreign policy just because of detente. And they've said this many times as well. And I think that's really what that's all about.
And is there any, in Cuba, is there much attention being paid to the presidential primaries? There was, of course, in the recent debate in Florida between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, the issue of Cuba came up, and an old interview of Bernie Sanders was played from the 1980s where he was quite sympathetic to Cuba and castigated the U.S. for all of its interventions during the Cold War, and in particular in Latin America. Did that get any play?
Well, of course it does. You know, I think on Cuban television, both in the news and in some of their talk shows, they're discussing a lot what's going on in the presidential primary. And, of course, they put specific focus, actually, not on Sanders, but on the two Cuban-Americans who were running. One, Rubio, has now dropped out. So they kind of use them as a foil. You know, they put them up on television here and say, you see, well, you know, these people still exist over there, and we can't assume they're totally out of the picture just because, you know, we're improving our relations.
Well, one of them has dropped out, but the other one is becoming the Republican Party establishment's, you know, hope to rescue them from the portent of Donald Trump becoming president of the United States. So it's not as if the Cuban Americans are disappearing from the scene. You've still got Ted Cruz.
Exactly. And the Cubans are very aware of it, both in the government and in the population.
And are they concerned about a Trump presidency?
I think the entire world's a little bit concerned about a Trump presidency. I mean, the Cuban government doesn't really, you know, take particular sides in the Republican primary. I mean, I think they probably would be happy if Hillary Clinton or a Democrat won, obviously, in terms of their relations with the United States. And Trump is just put out there like he is everywhere, says, you know, the kind of bad face of the United States. And they do that here like they do everywhere else.
So just in general then, Mark Frank, I take it that there's obviously a lot of optimism and joy, in fact, at what's happening this evening. I think you said around 4:30, Obama arrives in Havana.
Yeah.
And
yes, that's what he said.
And what are you going to be doing? What are you covering initially? Is there going to be any kind of open engagement with the Cuban people? Is Obama going to be able to make a speech in public?
Well, I mean, you know, very few details of the choreography, the detailed choreography, have been released by either side. So we're making assumptions, okay? We assume there's going to be quite a reception for him at the airport. We assume he's going to get in his car and there's going to be people along the route. We know he's going to, like, take a walk around the colonial part of Havana, and we assume there will be some people there. And then he's going to do some private stuff, I think, later on this evening. So that's what's going to be going on today, right? So we'll all be waiting for the airport. We'll all be keeping an eye on the motorcade and what happens in Old Havana. He's going to meet with the Cardinal, who, as you know, has played a role in both supporting reforms here and in the U.S.-Cuban thaw. So that's pretty much what we're expecting today.
And so there will be some pictures then of Obama and his wife walking through Old Havana and the Malecón, do you think?
No, we assume that.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Oh, and admiring all of those extraordinarily maintained vintage American cars, which in many ways are a reminder of the time warp, right?
Yeah, kind of on both sides. Our policy and their cars.
Well, Mark, I thank you very much for joining us. I take it it's a pretty joyous day there in Havana.
Yeah, you know, I've been here many years, and I'm certainly personally, I respect both sides for trying to, you know, we are neighbors, to try to figure out a way to live together. I think that's a good thing for all the Cuban people inside and outside of Cuba. So I certainly hope it goes well.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Mark Frank.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Mark Frank, who's a freelance journalist based in Cuba, who works for Thomson Reuters and the Financial Times and consults for ABC News and has contributed to The Economist and Argentina's Clarín. He's the author of Cuba Looks to the Year 2000 and Cuban Revelations Behind the Scenes in Havana. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Bill Velasquez, National Director of Latino Outreach for the Bernie Sanders Campaign. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bill Velasquez.
Thank you for having me.
And I take it, Bill, you're very busy down in Arizona. And do you think that Bernie Sanders can pull off another come-from-behind victory that he did in Michigan and almost did in Missouri?
And almost did in Illinois as well. We seem to have that the tendency, and I think it comes from early polling, the early reputation of the other side working the state, but then the Sanders campaign being able to really promote our message to the people. We do our part to promote it to Latino voters, and we seem to come on pretty late and get a lot of victories. So we are certainly hoping that that's going to happen here in Arizona, and we have indications that we are definitely catching fire here.
So what are the latest indications? Last time I checked, Hillary Clinton had about a 20-point lead.
Yes. If you look at the last polls, certainly she has, or at least the polls dictated that she had a lead. I go by anecdotal evidence on the ground. I go by seeing turnouts at phone banks and turnouts for canvassing and the large amount of support we have at rallies here in Arizona and Flagstaff and Phoenix and Tucson. Everywhere we go, it seems to be that people are really catching on to the campaign's message. I see a lot of Latinos who normally are not the strongest voters really coming out and really supporting Bernie Sanders. And again, that's the kind of things I've seen in other states that we've worked. We worked Iowa, won the majority of the Latino vote. We worked Nevada, won a lot of the majority of the Latino vote. Won in Colorado, also had the majority of the Latino vote. So I see these same indicators, and so I feel really good about where we're at this point in the campaign in Arizona.
And do you think the protests helped or hurt, particularly the one that took place where the highway was blocked, blocking Trump supporters from getting to their rally?
Well, I want to first say that the campaign has nothing to do with organizing those protesters. We do not put out the call for them to do that. We certainly don't want anybody's rights to be trampled on, and we're certainly concerned with any violence at these Trump rallies, and that's our main concern. We think that the Trump campaign has done everything possible to foment an atmosphere of antagonism, of racism, of violence, and we condemn that, and we don't support that at all. And obviously, that message is resonating with others as well. And people are very concerned about this new trend toward a xenophobic America. And so we don't support that at all, but we don't organize the protesters at all. They're not our people. They happen, in many cases, as we've seen, they happen to be supporters of Bernie, but we do not organize them.
Well, it seems to me, though, Bill Velasquez, again, the national director of Latino Outreach for the Bernie Sanders campaign, that this student protest movement is spontaneous. It clearly has nothing to do with your campaign, the Bernie Sanders campaign, but it's growing and it's getting more and more creative and more and more likely to become the focus of Donald Trump's campaign throughout this election season. If anything, I think, is going to cause him trouble, it will be this constant reminder to the American people that Donald Trump is the candidate of chaos.
I like that. That's a great term.
Tell Bernie he's welcome to plagiarize me.
The candidate of chaos. Okay. I will definitely let them know. We're one of the things that's really come out of this campaign that I'm so proud of is that we're activating voters who have never voted before. So many of these millennials never voted in a presidential election. Many of them have never voted in any type of election. And yet not only are they inspired to come out and support our campaign, they're inspired to be politically active, to share their feelings, to condemn Donald Trump and his views. I think that it's a new era of political activism in the United States. I think we can have Bernie Sanders to thank for that. I think ultimately we will be successful and we'll be able to turn American politics on its head. But even if we aren't, I think that the new wave of political activism is here to stay, and I welcome it.
So how are you doing in Utah?
Very well. You saw that we had a rally of 14,000 people in Salt Lake City. We were very pleased with that. Again, in the, we don't have any new poll numbers to tell you, so there's no magic there. What we do have is real on-the-ground interactions, the response of voters, the response of volunteers. We think we're going to do very well on Tuesday in Arizona, Utah, and Idaho.
And Utah and Idaho are both caucuses, right? Arizona is a primary.
Correct.
And in general, though, Bernie Sanders lately has been making the argument that to sort of write him off earlier because Hillary Clinton has a delegate lead, which is the tendency in the press, you know, there it's all about process, who's up and who's down, that really is flies in the face of American democracy, and it means that all of these big states like California and New York essentially don't get a say because somebody's already been declared the winner by the press and therefore nobody pays any attention. And I think he's got a very strong point, you know.
You know, Ian, it's disappointing and puzzling at the same time. I know if I were a news editor, what I would want is a competitive race, right? When people go to see a sporting match or a horse race, they want to see a competition. They don't want to see a slaughter. They don't want to see an early decision. I don't understand what the tendency is of the American media to try to call an election early and try to say that one candidate has absolutely no chance over another candidate when we're seeing week to week that it's going back and forth, that she wins some and he wins some. And some of them are very tied. And again, the media narrative is, oh, she won and he lost. Let's be realistic about what we're winning. We're winning delegates. She may have won Illinois by less than 2 percentage points, but we practically split the delegates there. We were only a difference of 1 or 2 delegates. Same in many states. So this won or loss, we're very tight. If it hadn't been for her dominance in the southern states, we would be neck and neck right now. We might even be ahead.
And, of course, ironically, the Democrats are not going to win any of those southern states in the general.
Exactly, which is, again, nobody's focusing on that and saying, oh, wow, she swept all the southern states, but you'll never have a chance to win them in the general election. And they're not saying that. They're just saying that in the race between Hillary and Bernie, she's winning and he should get out. And I don't subscribe to that. I subscribe to the narrative where we should have competitive political races where both sides are putting forth different ideas, ideas that should be debated, that should be thought through and considered carefully before making a choice. I don't subscribe to the old way of just let's just have one winner who's locked down everything and let's move on because I don't see there's much of a choice.
Well, short of having a national primary, which would make sense, but obviously it's very hard to change the conventions, you know, with states like Iowa and New Hampshire locking in their early advantage and then this long drawn-out process, and we know it costs a lot of money, and as Les Moonves, the head of CBS, recently said, you know, I love this election season, I love Donald Trump because we're just getting a lot of eyeballs and making a lot of money. So there's lots of reasons why it would make more sense to have a national primary. But in terms of what you're talking about, the idea that the media, in effect, declare who the winner is, and then the rest of the electoral season in terms of these huge primaries in the biggest states like New York and California essentially become irrelevant. I recall when Jimmy Carter lost the presidency to Ronald Reagan, he declared defeat earlier, before they'd finished voting in California, and people were furious. And that's pretty much the same thing that we're talking about here, aren't we?
Well, I would say this. I would say certainly not over. I would say that states that we expected HRC to dominate in, she has dominated, and a lot of those states are now a done deal. We have states coming up in primarily in the West and the Southwest, that we feel extremely confident in winning handily. And I think that, if anything, people in the June primary states should be extremely happy because their states are actually going to be in play here. People, I think, it's going to be a competitive race all the way through the end of the primary season. And you will finally have a battle for the hearts and minds of the voters in California, which is going to be extremely exciting. California may very well dictate who the Democratic nominee will be. I'm certainly ready for the challenge, and I'm sure the other side is as well. And California voters should expect a very exciting primary season. This is the way it should be. Every state's opinion should count in the primary season. We shouldn't be writing anyone off, any state off, because they're later in the primary season. And I think we're going to get a good debate here going on, and I think we're definitely going to be competitive all the way through June.
Well, Bill Velasquez, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Ian. It was a pleasure being here.
And again, I've been speaking with Bill Velasquez, who is the National Director of Latino Outreach for the Bernie Sanders campaign. He joined us from Arizona.
Send someone away. Got my back covered. Said, how you been all that astray? Come, let's count. It's absurd. They lead you to the race, but no one's asked them to.
And joining us now is Rodolfo Espino, who's a professor of political science at Arizona State University, where he specializes in American politics, racial politics, and political behavior. He's the editor of Latino Politics, Identify, Mobilization, and Representation. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rodolfo
Espino. Thank you for
Espino.
Having me.
Now, Rodolfo, there's been quite a bit of violence at the Trump rally there was in Arizona. A protester, curiously enough, named Brian Sanders, no relationship to the candidate, when he was being led out of the rally, a man ripped up his sign and then punched him, and then he got sucker punched and kicked to the ground, and they did arrest a Trump supporter. And then another protester wearing a white hood like the KKK delivering the Nazi salute, he was hustled out, and Donald Trump said he's disgusting. He thinks he's cute. He's a disgusting guy, etc. So we've seen this continuum of protesting at Trump rallies, but there was also a protest where a highway was blocked leading to a Trump rally. And what was your sense of that? My sense is that these student protests are getting very creative and much more organized, and they're likely to dog Trump all the way to November.
Yes, indeed. But in some ways, these protests are just going to fuel more support for Trump because, the protesters, of course, the dump Trump supporters are to the far left, and it's just going to fuel more support to supporters for Trump from the far right. And what he's saying resonates a lot, especially here in Arizona, his comments on immigration about, he's going to make the wall higher and he's going to make Mexico pay for it. That resonates with a lot of far right voters who are white and feel that they're losing jobs to Mexicans that are coming here. And so what he's a good salesman. And so that's why he's doing so well in these Republican primaries.
So when Donald Trump says, as he did in Arizona, so much crime, drugs pouring through the border, people are now seeing it. And you know what? we're going to build a wall and we're going to stop it. It's going to end. That, even though we've heard that before, it has absolutely disgusted and outraged a number of people in this country, in particular the people that, in many ways, who are being scapegoated, which is immigrants from Mexico. What's your reading on that? I mean, I saw a piece on the news of a young woman a U.S. citizen of Mexican descent, said, "I'm not a drug dealer. I'm not a criminal. I'm not a rapist. Hatred is a very dangerous poison in the soul of humanity."
Yeah, he's scaring a lot of people of, you know, from Mexico that are now here in this country, undocumented or who are even citizens. And he's making these claims that he has this plan, to increase jobs by, he's going to recreate the Bracero program, where he's going to bring people from Mexico to cheap labor, but then send them back to Mexico. The Bracero program was a horrible thing, but it's slave labor, and this is what he's advocating for, and it's scaring a lot of Hispanics. And I anticipate that once we get to the general election, because I anticipate it's going to be a Clinton versus Trump general election, that you're going to see a lot of Hispanics turn out to vote. and he had a silly claim recently where he had this one Latino lady in an audience and was holding up a "I support Trump" sign and says, "See, the Hispanics love me." But that's absolutely not true. He's alienating all Hispanics and creating a lot of fear. So, again, I anticipate that you're going to see a lot of Hispanic turnout in the general election.
So how do you balance that with what you said earlier, Rodolfo Espino, that these protests are going to, by what you described as left-wing or far-left-wing protesters, many of whom were Latinos, that's going to just help Trump? So balance that out with the idea that you get more Latinos are going to show up to vote in November.
Yeah, in the general election. But right now, these protests, what they're doing is for people that are leaning to the right or your Republican voters, when they see these protests, they it creates more anxiety that, oh my God, there's going to be more jobs taken away by Latinos or by Latinos coming from Mexico. And that just fuels more support for Trump. And he knows, again, he's a great salesman. So he's playing to the audience. He's playing to the crowd.
Well, as I mentioned, though, in the interview with Bernie Sanders, Latino Outreach Director, National Director for Latino Outreach, Bill Velasquez, just preceding you on the program, Rodolfo Espino, that these student protests are going to get more frequent and more creative throughout this entire election season. I think they're going to dog Trump all the way till November. And in many ways, the optics are going to make Trump appear to be the candidate of chaos. What do you think of that?
Yeah. No, I agree with that. What's amazing to me about the Democratic primary election, and frankly, it looks like Clinton, she's way ahead in the delegate count right now. And I'm glad that Sanders is still in the race because, it should be a competitive primary election. But what amazes me about Sanders' campaign is his appeal to young voters. He's receiving so much support from the youth. Also too from Latinos as well. But I think that, Clinton's going to receive a lot of support from Hispanic voters, mostly because of name recognition. But it's great to see that Sanders is in the campaign because it's keeping Hillary on her feet, on her toes, so to speak, because we should have competitive elections. Go ahead.
Well, ultimately, do you think that Hillary's going to win in Arizona? Is that what you're going to say?
Yeah, I anticipate that Hillary's going to win because once it moves to the general election, you're going to have a lot of Latino and independents come and just recognize that Trump is just insane, and he's going to ruin the country. And I'm also amazed too about how much of the rest of the world. I have colleagues in many countries who keep asking me, "Why is Trump winning? What's wrong with American voters?" And I said, "Well, this is just the primaries. Wait till the general election, and you'll see what happens."
Right, but just to touch on Arizona, do you think on Tuesday Hillary Clinton's going to win, or that you think Bernie's going to pull off another one of his come from behind surprises?
I anticipate that probably Hillary. I mean, it's going to be close, but I anticipate that Hillary probably will lock it up.
So let's turn then, because we've only got a couple of minutes left, to Bernie Sanders' wife showing up at the Tent City, the infamous Tent City prison of Joe Arpaio's, where he sort of ambushed her. And frankly, I don't think she was particularly effective. She was there ostensibly with the families of these inmates who are kept in these inhumane conditions in these tents in the sweltering desert. And this jovial kind of avuncular character, Joe Arpaio, shows up and is real nice and friendly. And that flies in the face of the fact that this guy's committing human rights abuses. This is cruel and unusual punishment. This guy's a sadist. I mean, he's not somebody to be nice to.
Exactly. And so it's no surprise that Arpaio, and frankly, that he's endorsed Trump, because their politics are on the same page. They're both sadists. But yeah, there was a lot of news coverage of Jane Sanders showing up to Tent City. And this Tent City is inhumane. And frequently there are protests and marchers outside Tent City wanting to shut it down. But it's only going to get shut down once Joe Arpaio finally dies. And he's up there in years, so it might happen quite soon.
So that's the only way it's going to happen. I thought the feds had come down on Arpaio.
Yeah, they have. But, you know, he keeps moving along. And Arizona is still a really red state. So, you know, the state legislature, the governor, keeps funneling money to him. And it's just going to be a matter of time until he passes away, and that's, in my opinion, that's the only way that Kent City is going to get shut down. But it was heartwarming that Jane Sanders showed up to Kent City to visit the inmates, because it really is inhumane, especially in the Arizona heat during the summer. Those inmates are suffering, and it's cruel and unusual punishment.
Well, Rodolfo Espino, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Rodolfo Espino, who's a professor of political science at Arizona State University, where he specializes in American politics, racial politics, and political behavior. He's the editor of Latino Politics, Identity, Mobilization, and Representation. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.